Today we're going to talk about finance and development or growth. Let's begin with what finance does. I see the financial system as having five major benefits. One, consumption smoothing. Second, bridging the gap between savers and investors. Screening and monitoring of investments. And diversifying and transforming risk and managing the payment system. I'm going to say a little bit more about 1, 2, and 3 as we go along. I'm not going to say very much about 4 and 5 in this lecture or even in this course. Let me just mention very briefly what I mean by diversification and transformation of risk. A lot of what the financial system does is it takes short-term liabilities and turns those into long-term assets. So, for example, it takes a demand deposit, a deposit which the depositor can get back on demand and turns those into long-term loans. The shadow banking system took overnight loans, repo, and turned those into valuable investments. Now, we could say a lot more about what happens when this transformation of risk goes wrong, what happens with leverage and so forth. But we'll save that for another time. Also, managing the payment system, like creating currency and checks and making it easier to buy and sell, to transfer money. One of the big things about that makes understanding the financial system important but also so difficult is that the payment system is tied so closely with these other aspects of the financial system, so that when the transformation of risk, for example, goes wrong, we have a collapse in the payment system at the same time, and that causes all kinds of macroeconomic problems. In any case, those are problems for another day. Let's say a little bit more about 1, 2, and 3, most important for development. One of the things the financial system helps people to do is to smooth their consumption over their lifetime. So, for example, most people don't want to consume everything that they earn in their working years, leaving them nothing for retirement or for the times when they can no longer work. So they save up, and the financial system helps them to save by channeling those savings into productive investments so the savers can be paid an interest rate. Similarly, most people don't want to wait until they've accumulated enough assets to be able to buy a house or a car. They'd like to consume the house early on and instead smooth out the payments over time. So that's what a mortgage allows people to do. It allows them to smooth their consumption, have the house early on in life, and pay for it over time. The poor in the developing world also want a consumption smooth. But for them, in addition to consumption smoothing over their lifetime, they often want a consumption smooth over a mere period of weeks or even of days. So most people would prefer, you know, a few meals a day, square meals a day, rather than feast or famine. So to avoid that successive feast or famine, what the poor do is they make use of small savings accounts, small means of saving, sometimes literally under the mattress, and so micro loans and so forth, borrowing from a moneylender. We're going to be talking more about this in our discussion of microfinance. Getting beyond consumption smoothing, a big part of what the financial system does is it takes the supply of savings and it moves that supply of savings to the demanders for savings, firms and entrepreneurs in particular. So it takes people who are saving, households, perhaps they're saving up for retirement, it takes those funds and through banks and the bond market and stock markets, it delivers those funds to people who have ideas. That's a key aspect of specialization, is that the people with the money are not always the people with the ideas. The people with the ideas are not always with the people with the money. So you want some institutions, banks, bond markets, stock markets, venture capitalists, and so forth. You want these institutions to be able to bridge the gap, to take the supply of savings, which is not doing anything useful, which is sitting under the mattress, and instead turn those savings into valuable investments with people who have ideas. And this is all about what the financial system does, bridges this gap. Part of bridging the gap is screening and also monitoring of investments. So venture capitalists, they don't just throw out their money willy-nilly. the investigate, the help, the monitor, the mentor, people with whom they're going to invest, the decide how the funds of society are going to be allocated to really new speculative risky ideas. In this way, these screen ideas. Banks do the same thing, of course, less risky ideas, but banks screen new investments, they screen borrowers, they decide how the savings of their depositors are going to be allocated. Who has a good idea, who doesn't have a good idea, who is likely to pay the money back, who is less likely to pay the money back. So that's a lot of screening. The bond, and in particular the stock markets, also monitor investments. You can see on a daily basis how different companies, how different firms are doing. This shows from Google Finance. This is a graph of what has happened to Apple stock and Hewlett-Packard stock over the past 5 years. And you can see in 2007, they're basically the same. But since 2007, even in as late as 2008, they're about the same. But since that time, Apple stock has gone up by 600%. So Apple has clearly done something right. On the other hand, Hewlett-Packard stock has fallen. This is by about 50%. So this tells investors that the management of Apple is doing really well. They are to be rewarded. While Hewlett-Packard is doing less well, the managers, perhaps we need a new group of managers in here. So this is a way of monitoring investments and seeing what's going on in real time. Of course, the key question here is, does finance lead to growth? Does finance help development? Certainly, if you take a first pass, quick look at the data, it seems that they're related. If you look at the low-income countries, this is stock market capitalization as a fraction of GDP. Well, if you look at low-income countries, you know, stock markets are just not, they're a small share of GDP, much smaller than in high-income countries, where stock market capitalization can be almost as high on average, this is on average, as GDP. So in the United States, that would mean stock market capitalization on the order of $13 trillion. This is for all high-income countries, almost one-to-one with GDP, much less for low-income countries. We see very much the same pattern for private credit as a share of GDP. So in low-income countries, there's not a lot of borrowing or lending, actually, overall. In high-income countries, much, much more. So using this number as the number for the United States, for example, I don't know the exact numbers, but using this as representative, this means that in the United States, there's about $13 trillion of lending, borrowing out there, but the same as the amount of GDP. Quite a remarkable amount of borrowing and lending going on, not so much over here. Now, one might respond to this that this isn't causal. I mean, you could point out, for example, that there are more television sets in high-income countries, but this doesn't mean that cable TV creates growth. Rather, it's the case that television sets are a response to high income, not a cause of high income. So perhaps private credit is a response to high income, not a cause of high income. So to show causality, we want to investigate this in a little bit more depth. We're going to look briefly at two papers which try and get at, is the relationship between finance and growth or GDP per capita, is it causal or is it just a correlation? The first is by Bob King and Russ Levine, Finance and Growth, Schumpeter Might Be Right. They look at 77 countries between 1960 and 1989. Now, they don't simply show that in 1989, the rich countries had, you know, more financial development. What these show, which suggests, which doesn't prove, but which suggests a more causal effect, is that financial development in 1960 is a good predictor of economic growth over the next 30 years. So what they did is they took a number of measures of financial development in 1960, including the amount of private credit relative to GDP, and countries which did better on these measures, which had more developed financial markets, they grew faster over the next 30 years. In particular, not simply in GDP per capita, but also in productivity, which is where we'd expect to see the influence of finance, is in productivity growth. So this suggests that it was the greater financial development in 1960 which improved investments, which improved the ability to take savings and turn them into productive investments, to monitor those investments, to screen those investments, that these better measures of financial development, these more development, actually led to growth. A second paper in this literature by Rajanans and Gales, Financial Dependence and Growth, took another task at this. They looked at 36 industries across 42 different countries. And what they found was that industries which are more dependent on external finance, they benefit the most from financial development. So that again suggests that there's a causal relationship between financial development and the development of these industries. And what they did was really quite clever. They said, well, the U.S. probably has the most developed financial market. So let's look at the industries in the United States which use a lot of credit in order to develop. That is, which don't have the resources to self-finance. Instead, they must borrow. So let's look at industries which borrow a lot in the United States. And let's look at those same industries in other countries and see whether the growth of those industries is tied with the financial development of those other countries. And what they found is that industries which required more external finance, as indicated by how much external finance they had in the United States, those industries grew more in countries which had more financially developed markets. So again, this suggests that, you know, some industries, they can get by without a lot of finance. They generate enough revenue on their own to self-finance, small industries, small businesses, as well as some businesses which you don't require a lot of upfront costs, so they can finance as they go along. But other industries, industries which require a lot of upfront costs, like laying cable TV, for example, requires a lot of costs before you ever see a dime of revenue. Those industries really depend upon the financial development of the country, the banking system, the stock markets, the bond markets, and so forth. They require a well-developed financial system in order to succeed. The bridge between savers and borrowers can be broken in many different ways. So insecure property rights. So for example, if you can't trust your bank account, if the government may expropriate your bank account, as has happened a number of times in Argentina, then people don't want to put their money in the banks. And because the money is kept under the mattress instead of in the banks, it doesn't fund firms and entrepreneurs and so forth. Politicized lending is a problem. The idea of the bridge is to connect people with money with people with ideas, not to connect people with money with people with connections. Connections don't generate productivity. So we want to make sure that the bridge is driving funds from the savers to people who have real ideas who can improve productivity. Government banks are another sign of another source of loss. So government banks tend to be quite inefficient. They tend to be closely connected with politicized lending. In contrast with what we found about a more developed financial system in 1960 leading to greater growth, what has been found by André Schleifer and colleagues with government banks is that more government banks in 1970 created or were correlated with lower growth over the next 30 years or so. Interest rate controls, particularly interest rate controls when combined with inflation, can turn savings accounts into wasting accounts. If your interest rate is not keeping up with the inflation rate, then your money in a savings account is just disappearing, is just wasting away. And for this reason, people don't want to put their money in banks. And if they're not putting their money in banks, then it's probably not being lent out to firms and entrepreneurs. Finally, and this is important for developed economies, bank failures and panics. You know, bank failures and panics destroy this bridge. We saw this with the collapse of the shadow banking system. People pulling their money out of the shadow banking system meant that a lot of credit was no longer available to fund good ideas, and that has had a significant effect on our economy. So we need ways to make sure that banks, while incentivized to do that screening and monitoring, are still protected from panics. We don't get unjustified panics. Okay. For further reading, in addition to the articles I've already mentioned, you may wish to check out Ross Levine's 2004-2005 review article, Finance and Growth. This is a very long article, but it's comprehensive on the literature up until that time. Thanks.